I don't think we're going to finish this topic this week. I actually made 17 pages of sources for you, which the machine simply couldn't handle. So, it wasn't for today. It was for this week and next week. So we will continue next week. We'll just at least get started, unless I change my mind in the middle, which is, of course, always possible. Remind me to tell you something at the end of class. You can do that? You can't tell. You remind me at the end. Source number one. This is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. We're going to see, after the Mishnah, we'll see a couple of Gemarot, and then we'll be able to start to understand the issue. Rebbe Omer, now I skipped a couple of lines. V'hevi zihir b'mitzvah kala uv'chamura. Be careful with a quote-unquote a small mitzvah, as you would, or a light mitzvah, kala would be a light mitzvah, as you would with one which is a serious, chamor, which is a serious mitzvah. Which I guess is good advice, otherwise everyone would just do the serious mitzvah and we'll leave all the... I believe the Vilna Gaon says that in his commentary on Pirkei Avot. People would just ignore the other ones. You know, it's if you have limited time and you get the most bang for your buck, so I guess the capitalistic approach towards mitzvot would be go for the maximum payback for the mitzvot. So what the Mishnah doesn't tell us is what exactly is considered to be a light mitzvah or a small mitzvah. The Rambam, in his commentary to the Mishnah, gives us two examples. That people think is light, which means you don't always know what's light and what's not light. People don't always know. Kigon simchat haregel, which may be a challenge when Pesach arrives, to have real joy on the holiday, simchat haregel. And the second one he writes is the limidat lashon kodesh, and the learning of Hebrew. So that seemed, in the Rambam's time, again, appreciate the Rambam, most of the books that he wrote, he did not write in Hebrew, which is, we still suffer today. Even the book that we're reading from right now, the Parish of the Mishnah, was written in Arabic. I mean, the Rambam wrote his first book, which was a dictionary of philosophic terms when he was 16. And he wrote the Parish of the Mishnah, he was around 20, 21 years old when he wrote this. I mean, quite... The Yad HaChazakah was the one that he wrote in Hebrew, and that he wrote around the age of 60. It was 60, many, many, many years later. Anyway, so the Rambam tells us that what is the mitzvah kala? It is the learning of Lashon Kodesh. Now, I'm going to be a little careful, because is Lashon Kodesh necessarily the same thing as Ivrit? Okay, and there are those who could say oh, absolutely, and some can say not necessarily. I mean, if you were to ask, then the father of modern Hebrew is Eliezer ben Yehuda. Eliezer ben Yehuda made up all kinds of words, and he took Israel from, he took Hebrew from quote unquote a dead language, and he turned it into a living language, because Hebrew was not really used in a day-to-day, yes?
No, it's related to what you're saying. Would that mean that the shurim that there are less valuable than the ones downstairs in Hebrew? Would that be his opinion?
I'm sure they have better teachers.
Does he assume that learning about the Hebrew and so on in a foreign language would be less valuable?
He said this is a mitzvah kala. You could do, again, he didn't give us more information what to do with it, but he felt that the learning of Hebrew is a mitzvah kala that most people, through most of history, have ignored. Okay, I think that's a very fair and valid point. Again, the only reason I brought the source here is to find somebody who's pointing and talking about learning. I mean, we could have brought others, but this was easy and accessible.
Where does it say that it's a mitzvah to learn Lashon HaKodesh?
The Rambam just said it over here. That's why I brought this. Source number two. Something being considered one of the Tariyag Mitzvot is not necessarily the most important issue. I mean, I could say that it's part of Talmud Torah and it's very difficult to learn. Then if I'll say it's Talmud Torah, you'll tell me that women are a patur. I say women are patur, then you'll get upset. So we're not going there. Anyway. one of the things that happened with the language of Hebrew coming alive is that people started to speak it. And when people started to speak it, as I said, Eliezer ben Yehuda and others helped create this language. But there was something else that happened. And that is that there were different ways that Hebrew was pronounced in almost every single community. I mean, I can talk about slighter nuances from northern Galicia to southern Galicia, the way that that a Litvak versus somebody from Tayman versus somebody in Morocco, but I'm even sure that within Morocco, again, there would be a difference between north and south and east and west and so on and so forth. And there are different ways that Hebrew was pronounced in different places, all of them having specific advantages and all of them having particular disadvantages to them when compared to one another. And somebody decided that the way that modern Hebrew should be spoken was in Sfaradit, or almost Sfaradit, and that is, instead of Sfaradis, they would say Sfaradit, and so on. So I'm not going to get into all of the nuances, but the question comes up then, first of all, if somebody was brought up in a custom speaking in Ashkenazis, are they permitted simply to change their Mivta? Are they able to change, or the Havara, are they able to change the way that they speak? If somebody, for example's custom is to speak in Ashkenazis and they're in a shul that they read the Torah in Sfaradit, or the Yotze, if they get up to David in that shul as a Shliach Tzibur, how should they conduct themselves? I'm saying all kinds of questions came up, including questions which, okay, some questions addressed the individual, some questions addressed the community, some questions addressed major educational issues on what language should be or how should Hebrew be taught in schools. So these are the various issues that come up. We're going to look at a couple of Gemaras and then just to have a little bit of a foundation, and then we'll see how the various poskim deal with it. I heard that this week they had some kind of a celebration of 90 years to the establishment of the chief rabbinate. I don't know if any of you missed that. I mean, you may... What?
I'm afraid so.
What the status of the chief rabbinate is today is another very interesting question that we will not necessarily address. Although I do have the opinions of a bunch of chief rabbis along the way, and other people who maybe should have been chief rabbis that we will look at. And part of the problem why I had so many sources is that there were just so many different tshuvot that just approached differently. Even after cutting it down, as I said, I was still left with 17 pages of sources, which I really hope to get through a lot of them this week and more of them next week. But here's a book which is called Shelot U'Tshuvot Mishpatei Uziel. I could say Uziel, but he would have said Uziel. He was a chief rabbi of Israel. Ben Tzion Meir Chai Uziel. He was born in Jerusalem. He was the Sephardic chief rabbi. He was the first Sephardic chief rabbi after the establishment of the state. There was another chief rabbi. No, Herzog was, sorry, Ashkenazi. There was another Sephardic chief rabbi before him when the chief rabbi was first established. What's interesting about the book over here is that the two chief rabbis have Michtavei Bracha. One of them is Rav Yaakov Meir, Rishon HaRabbanim Be'eretz Yisrael, Rishon Letzion, the Sephardic chief rabbi, Rav Meir, if you've never heard of him. I believe he died in 1938 or 39 or so. The other is Rav Avram Yitzchak Kohen Cook, who died in 1935. Rav Uziel was the Sephardic rabbi in Yafo. This is before there was a Tel Aviv, by the way. In Yafo, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi was Rav Cook. And they were both the chief rabbis of Yafo, which will later one day become Tel Aviv Yafo. And But Rav Cook becomes appointed in, I guess if now it's 90 years, I guess it was around 1921 or so, was appointed chief rabbi of Palestine, right? And at the same time, Rav Meir is appointed the chief Sephardic rabbi known as the Chacham Bashi or the Rishon Letzion. What's interesting over here is he has a tshuva, Rav Uziel, about speaking Hebrew, and we'll see it later on, and Rav Cook addresses it in his quote-unquote divrei bracha or haskama. So here you have haskama saying ani lo maskim, because Rav Kook argues very forcibly against what Rav Uziah wrote over here. So I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. By the way, what do you think Rav Kook said?
What did Rav
Uziah
say?
Then you know what Rav Kook said. I mean, what? I need that. I need Rav Kook. Rav Kook absolutely said that anybody who's Ashkenazi should keep on davening in their Havara and should not change it. This is one of
davening,
and this is one of the psukim of Rav Kook that virtually all of his followers completely ignored. Okay, so just I saw a friend of mine at a wedding last night. I won't quote his name, but he is a Talmud Chacham, and he told me that he davened for the Yomid someplace in a certain shul in Jerusalem. And he davened Ashkenazis, and somebody came over to him and says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm following Rav Kook," and they couldn't believe him. They just didn't believe that this is Rav Kook who we may be following. But as I said, we're getting way ahead of ourselves. I take that back. I heard of actually one follower of Rav Kook, okay, one, who's a prominent Rav who follows him on this. Okay, let's begin, and let's look at the Gemara in source number 3. Hakoreh tashma, this is a Mishnah in Brachot. Hakoreh tashma, v'lo hishmina la'ozno yatsa. If you read Shema, but your ears do not hear what your mouth enunciated, you're yotze, but it's not good, it's not proper. This is irrelevant for this. It's the continuation of the Mishnah that we really need. But if we're already reading this, the halacha is when you say Shema, it should be that your ears hear it. Shema should be loud enough that your ears hear what you're saying. But if you didn't do it, you still yotze. Rabbi Yossi Omer, lo yotze. Rabbi Yossi said, you're not yotze. Kara velo diktuk ba'otiyoteha. If you read and were not careful with the enunciation of the letters, Rabbi Yossi Omer yotze, Rabbi Yehuda Omer lo yotze. So here we have a machloket in the Mishnah, whether if you were imprecise in your pronunciation of the letters, whether you fulfilled the mitzvah of Shema or you did not fulfill the mitzvah of Shema. Okay, that's Mishnah number one that you should keep in mind. Second, a Gemara in a Mishnah again in Masechet Sota. The reason this enters Sota, what in the world does Sota have to do with everything else we're about to read, is that in the Mishnah in Sota has a side point, because one of the things the Sota has, there's a Parshat Sota. So it's a formal text that needs to be written, formal things need to be said. So from that, it goes to a general statement about what texts can be said in any language and what texts need to be specifically said in Hebrew. So, source number 4, Elu ne'emrim b'kol lashon. Here are things that can be said in any language. Parshat Sota, Vidui Ma'aser, Kriyat Shema v'tfilah, Ubirkat Hamazon. By the way, so far, what does this tell you? This tells you that if we'll ignore the Sot and the Vidui Maser right now, that if you don't feel comfortable with Hebrew and you want to say Shema and Shmona Esrei in English, what does the Mishnah say? It's absolutely fine. You will find, again, this is not the topic now. That English is not the topic for today. You will find later poskim saying, nonetheless, there's a preference and it's good and you're speaking in the proper language and so on and so forth. And after everything is said and done, yes, there's a preference to speak in Hebrew, but a person can be yotze shema and shmona esrei if they say it in English. That is a very clear halacha from the Mishnah. Vishvuata edut, vishvuata pikadon, these are also formal texts, can all be said in any language. Ve'elu ne'emrim b'lashon hakodesh, and these are things that need to be said in Hebrew. Mikra bikurim, right. V'chalitza, chalitza is if a woman's husband dies without children, and he has a brother, so then on a Torah level, the brother would either need to marry or to do this symbolic sending away, which is called chalitza. And here it tells us that there is a formal text that needs to be said in Hebrew. The Gemara will then try to bring proof for each point in the Mishnah why this can be said in any language and why this thing cannot be. Brachot uklalot, that has to do with Harigrizim and Harival. Birchat Kohanim has to be said in Lashon HaKodesh. Ubirchat Kohen Gadol. Uparshat HaMelech. Uparshat Egla Rufa. Umashuach Muchama Bishat Shemidabar Ela'am. So the Mishnah gave us all kinds of things that need to be said in Hebrew, but among the things that don't have to be said in Hebrew are... I'll ask that again. Among the things that don't need to be said in Hebrew are Shman Shmon Esrei, which means theoretically, what if you have a whole minion of people that want to daven in English? Are they allowed to daven in English? Yes. So presumably...
It's very personal. There's a differentiation here between something that's...
So presumably the answer is...
Yes.
Yes. Presumably the answer is yes. The Mishnah says that these things can be said in any language. Shema can be said in any language. Shmona Esrei can be said in any language. So prayers can be said in any language. That seems to be the Mishnah. Now, why is this relevant to our discussion?
Because the issue is whether you have to understand the language or whether you just have to say the
language. Okay, understanding is going to be one issue. That's very good. What else? What else would be... Why would this be... Why else would this be relevant for our discussion about why would this be relevant for our discussion about is a person allowed to daven or could be yotzei in a havara which isn't theirs? If I'm allowed to daven in English and I'm Ashkenazi, why could I not daven in Sfaradit? I mean, why would that be any worse than a different language? Okay? Just...
It really is apples and oranges because...
No, it's oranges and tangerines.
Clementines. Because how you pronounce a given language is very different than doing it in another language. The issue of the purity of the language or the custom of the language itself has no bearing on...
So what's a language?
I would think it's easier.
So what's a language? Yeah, that's right. It could be Kal V'Chomer. Tell her the Kal V'Chomer. That if...
Saying sa or ta is less of an issue than speaking thou, shall, or
right.
You know, saying it in Hebrew. When it's saying it in Hebrew.
But I don't see it as related. In other words, what you do in a given language, to me, is very different than doing a whole other language. If you are going to do English... The same thing. English, depending on how you pronounce it.
So does it need to be the Queen's English? I mean, there's at least one person in this room who will tell you that you don't speak English. I said at least one who will say that we don't.
How does Aramid fall into this category?
How does what?
Aramid
is also going to be interesting, but let's leave.
If you're thinking.
Okay.
And if you think in that language, then your belief system will be based on that kind of thinking.
Okay. Again, perhaps I want to go back to your first comment. Do you remember your first comment? Yeah, I liked your first comment. What was your first comment?
About understanding.
What is language?
It's also heritage.
Communication.
Language is communication.
Yeah, so language is going to be a question of communication. So therefore, you can argue that if I were to pray in French that I was not Yotzei, why would this be?
You understand what you said. Because nobody else understood.
No, because I don't understand what I said.
Between you and a close goal.
Does it matter if a person who doesn't understand English... prays in Hebrew, he's still...
So again, Hebrew may have some special qualities to it. So Hebrew may have some special qualities to it. But if I pray in a language, I don't know what I'm saying. So now, even though you can pray in every language, that could be somewhat questionable. You pointed out an issue of one of understanding. So therefore, if I were to pray in a Havara, that I understand what I'm saying, right? So then why would that be any worse than my praying in another language? So I'm not so convinced we have apples and oranges over here, but I'm saying that's something to take into consideration.
Doesn't the tzibor have to understand what you're saying?
Oh, very good. So now there may be a separate issue between my own personal prayer versus the tzibor. Correct, and that's what I said from the beginning, that there may be more than one issue involved. That's another point. Nusach is separate. Nusach is a separate point. Source number 5. This is a Gemara in Megillah. Tananami Hachi. It was similarly said. Ein moridin lufnei ateva lo anshe beit shan v'lo anshe beit chaifa. Lo anshe tivonin. No. You can't be a shleach tzibur. Bebnei shekorin la'alafin ayinin. Ula ayinin alafin. They confuse their alephs and their ayins.
Like most of us.
So that is a very interesting comment. It says that that people, and I, so now part of what we need to understand is, okay, so what's the problem that they confuse the two?
They're not precise in what they're saying.
Omrle Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi Levi Pasul Atam bin Haduchan Mishum to Avi Kolech. Because you would, if you were a Kohen, you would not be able to say Birkat Kohenim, because there's something funny about your voice. Ovi kolech. Ata amur le lavuha, amur le zil emele. Went and told his father. Ata, he went. Amur le lavuha, he told his father. Amale, his father's Rebbe, Rebbe Yudanasi. Amur le zil amale, go tell him. Kishatamagia etzel, vichikiti lahashem, lo nimtzeit macharefu magadef. When you get up to this verse in Yeshayahu and you try to read it, V'chikiti l'Hashem, aren't you going to come out cursing God? So what does this mean, cursing God? Look at Rashi in source number 6. Eitzel v'chikiti l'Hashem, in the second line, third line, Mikra zeh v'sefer Yeshayahu, lo nimtzeit mecharef megadef, shahaya korin l'chetin hein, nikra ka'omar v'hikiti. It's as if you struck God instead of v'chikiti. So Rashi doesn't seem to, well, Rashi is explaining the statement of Rebbe that the problem over here is one of the implications of the quote unquote misinterpretation. Right. Okay, so now we will go to Rav Kook's comments. Wait, this is
in Rosh Hashanah. If you pronounce the ayin and the aleph the same, then there are words like likroa or likro that would sound very different.
Right.
The meaning would change.
Right. So what you're pointing out is that Ashkenazic enunciation has a deficiency, and that is that the ayins and the aleph sound the same. On the other hand, you need to also acknowledge that Sephardic pronunciation has a deficiency, and that is that the patachs and the kamat and the kamatzes sound the same. So, we can keep on going. That's what I'm saying, that each one has an advantage, each one has a disadvantage. Okay, I'm getting way ahead of myself, but you'll notice what they've done in modern Hebrew, and this is the way they'll teach Hebrew in the vast majority of modern Orthodox schools in America. They'll teach it in Sfaradit in terms of the taf and the kamatz versus, and then the patach versus the kamatz, but they won't teach any of the guttural sounds. They won't teach the chet, and they won't teach the ayin, and they won't, and so on and so forth. So they lost the meaning. They lost the guttural sounds as Sfarad did, and then they lost the patach versus the kamatz in Ashkenaz. So they really have created something new. And if you'll be honest, this new thing which they created really is the vernacular Hebrew, which is used by most of society. So the question therefore, okay, now this is the vernacular, and a new spoken Hebrew has been created, but if we'll be honest, we'll at least have to admit that the new spoken Hebrew is neither Ashkenazic nor it is Sephardic. It is something new.
Hybrid.
You're right. Yeah.
My husband says in Slovak and always laughs that in Rosh Hashanah we say Hayom Harat Olam. He says that Tem Kolos Mono Rem Hayom Habas Olam. You know, with the Ashkenazim.
Don't let him in Ashkenazi Shul. Okay. Source number 7 is the tshuva from Rav Kook. You see that it's dated over here, Kaf Hei Tishrei Tafresh Tzadi Gimel, which means it's approximately 2 years before he passed away. This is 1933. He died in 1935. L'chvod Yedidi Hagon Ish Ashkalot B'Nosei Kodesh Morvrin Harav Shmuel Aaron Weber Shlita Hamazkir Harashi L'Rabbanut Harashit Be'eretz Yisrael Orech HaKol Torah Po Ir HaKodesh Yerushalayim Tibaneh V'Tikayin. So he's talking to somebody who's actually involved in the office of the Chief Rabbinate, and he publishes a journal. The journal is called Kol Torah, and Rav Kook published his tshuva, which is almost, I mean, he copied it over here. He originally wrote it as an article in this journal. Later on, it got into this Orech Mishpat, which is Shelot and Shuvot. As I said, it also appears over here as part of his Divrei Bracha to Rav Uziel, where he tells, where I'll just read to you the first line over here of his protest. And again, I told you, they were both chief rabbis together, and they worked together in Yafo. He says, "Inani bezeh lahair al divrei kodesho b'mashaleh b'tshuva harishona b'sifro," regarding the very first tshuva that you wrote over here. Where Rav Uziel says that any person can abandon their previous custom when they've now come to Israel and we're going to live in as a new society. There's no such thing as that you're abandoning your old customs by this. He says, Shehu lo kifi ma shetit parsem mimeni. You ignored what I've already published on this. And indeed he did. Okay. So Rav Kook, as you all now already understand, that he's going to come out and say that this is something that really cannot be done. Let's go from where it's underlined by the next paragraph. Be'inyan shinuyim b'mivta'im sheyeshnam bein ha'edot hashonot, regarding changing the enunciation of pronouncing Hebrew between the different communities, whether a person is allowed to change from enunciation from one to another, bitfilah, uvekriat Torah, ubebrachot, ukol kahigavna, and anything which is like this, nira hadvrim debidi eved ein shinuya miftaim me'akvim. He says, it seems to me that bidyeved, that means that after the fact, if a person did it, then we can't really protest too much. L'didon de kaimelan kod Yosef, because we follow the opinion of Yosef, which is, b'matnitzen brachot, d'kravelo dikdek botio te yotza, that if you read and you were not careful in how you pronounced it, you were yotze shema. Okay, that was one of the things that we had seen. And he says, we do follow Rabbi Yossi over here. So now once you know that we follow Rabbi Yossi, so bidi eved if you read it in a way which is inappropriate, you were Yotzei. So this really should be no different. By the way, you can now say to me, but hold it, if you even read it in another language, it's allowed. He doesn't get into that. Let's continue. Avalechadchila, but de jure, as it were, Vaday chove hi lomer kol devar shebikedusha bishleimut habitoy. The proper way to pray is certainly to say anything which is holy in the correct enunciation. Umemela asur l'shanot et minhaga kadmonim mibitoy lebitoy. And certainly we cannot change from the customs of the earlier generations from changing from one enunciation to another. Yes.
He's talking here, in the beginning it said, when it's b'diavad shinui hamivta'im, and then he's saying lo dikdik. There are two different things. Is he doing something wrong, or it's just that he has a different mivta from someone else?
He's saying it's not good. He's saying, again, he's saying that even if a person was lo dikdik ba'otiyoteh, if a person didn't pronounce the letters properly, they're yotzei. A person who doesn't pronounce it properly, they yotzei. So therefore, he says, "Bidi eved." I can't say a person who changed their mifta wasn't yotzei, because the worst comes to worst. What is this? It's no worse than lo diktek b'yotzei. But that's bidi eved. It's better to do it properly. After she yesh lekol bitoy diktukim miyuchanim b'tnuot v'havarot ha'otiyot. That each custom has their own way of reading things, whereby if you read it in one, it would be considered to be lo dikdek, that you didn't enunciate it properly according to the other. Right? If Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, right? That's a kamatz. If I read Hashem Echad, so I wasn't dikdek be'otiyoteh. Will it change the meaning of the word? It didn't change the meaning of the word. But what did I do? So I just now changed from reading in a way which according to my custom would have been dikdek be'otiyoteh, to read the letters properly, to lo dikdek. So what's the law if lo dikdek be'otiyoteh? What's the law? You're yotzei. But he says, why be yotzei b'di'evid? Why do it in an imperfect fashion? Try to do it in a perfect fashion. V'lo havi limudo tam, va'avar al memer d'rachmana d'gamrin shiye limud chatam. Your limud, I mean, it's not perfect, and you should try to do things in a perfect way, complete way. Ad shitzerich liten gam revech bein ha'dveikim v'kal v'chomer shasur lahavliya shumot v'shum nikudam yebitoy mekubal ba'oto ha'kahal. And so he's saying is that you should be read. How do I judge if you read the letters properly? But based upon, again, a combination of where you come from and where you're praying. V'hara'a b'sefer hachinach, and by the way, I just now skipped a substantial amount of the tshuva. The ra'a in sefer hachinach, don't get excited. We don't really know it's the ra'a. Ra'a is of Aaron Halevi. The sefer hachinach was written anonymously. So he's assuming, as some people do, that the sefer hachinach was written by Aaron Halevi. We don't really know who it's written by. But he says that the ra'a in sefer hachinach Katav shelo diktek ba'otiyoteh shebedi eved yatsa haynu dafka kishonotan revach bein hadvekim. That what does it mean? Meaning the Sefer Achinuch has a different understanding about what it means lo diktek ba'otiyoteh. It means that you didn't give enough space in between the letters. O shelo hitiz hazayin shel tizkaru. O shelo heirich bedalid echad. The siyam shem Achinuch the im chiser otiyot. Otevot lo yotza gam b'di'eved. He says, if your enunciation is in a way that you're missing something, then you're not yotze even b'di'eved. So he is going to latch onto the Sefer Achinuch and claim that he's a little concerned. V'al pize yesh ladun she'la shemifta itzlam mishuneh ba'otiyot. That different communities say the letters differently. Shehein mitba'ot ba'ofen acher b'ma she'cher mivta'im. It's not that you didn't give proper space. According to this opinion of the Sefer Achinuch, if I read it with a different miftah, the letter may be missing. If I pronounce an ayin as an aleph, and I pronounce it as an ayin, according to Rav Kook, it's not Mike, if I decide, you know what? Maybe the Yemenites got it right. Maybe they're the ones who really know. And we'll see that there are those who have claimed this along the way. Maybe the Yemenite pronunciation of the ayin is the proper way to pronounce it. Rav Kook is saying, excuse me, if I don't pronounce the aleph the way that I'm accustomed to pronouncing the aleph, that letter is missing. The aleph is missing. And according to the Chinuch, I wasn't yotzei davening. So that's interesting. Right? For example, as the Yemenites do pronounce certain things differently. Shuli? Your hand went up, or no?
It did.
You rethought. Im ken yesh lomo de hachinami de im ha'ota mivta lo nikar ba'oto hakal shu oto ha'ot yesh lomo de haviki ilu hishmit ha'ot lagamrei. If you pronounce something and not the way it's pronounced in that community, it's as if you skipped it. If that's the case, according to the Chinuch, the application of Yossi doesn't apply, and therefore you were not Yotze at all. Mikol ma shekatavnu mivu'ar she'ein shum makom lahatir l'shanot mivta l'mivta. My conclusion, Rav Kook says, is based upon all that we've seen, and as I said, I really did skip a great deal of it, that one has no permission to switch from one to another. Mishum de kol shinui nechshav l'gabe eila shechzikam mivta achar miklal kru v'lo diktuk bo'otea, that he's afraid that you're not reading it properly. ובייחוד מי שמשנה ממבטא התימני המוחזק אצלם מדרות הראשונים, שהוא המדויק שמבטאים כמפורסם. So here he admits that the Yemenite is the best way of pronouncing it, but he says, and a Yemenite should not abandon his custom. But again, he thinks no one should abandon their custom. A Yemenite should not abandon their custom. And again, it's just a very interesting admission. He says, it's, you know, as is well known, that the Yemenites may have had the best transmission of their customs, but still they shouldn't change it. Shibvade asu lasokin, they're certainly not allowed to change it. Ulafi divrei achinuch yishlomo deafilu b'di eved eni yotzim yidei chova b'bnei shenechshav ki ilu mechasrim otiyot lagamrei, which is, I'm repeating myself a bit here. Da'avi chamur tfei mikra v'lo dikdek b'otea v'afo pisha hurgal po be'eretz Yisrael litein yitron l'mivta hasfaradi. And even though here in Israel, so again he's telling you Israel 1933 or so, that there is a preference, meaning the word, the speaking of Israel on the street. So think about it. The Sfaradim are speaking b'mivta Sfaradit. Secular Zionists who have adopted it as well. So basically you have the old Yishuv who may or may not be speaking Sfaradit in terms of their general communication. So he writes, Zerak sheyeshlo ezechen v'yofi miyuchad. He says that why do people speak in Faradid? It has a certain attraction to it, a certain beauty to it. Aval ikar yitron mifta hu diyuko b'chiluk ha'otiyot v'nekudot uv'zeh mifta sfaradi einu magia gam l'mifta ashkenazi. Again, what bothers him? What bothers him? By the way, I can assure you that Rav Ovadia doesn't agree. Yeah, what bothers him is the loss of the Kamatz. the loss of the kamatz, the suf and the tuf and so on. He says it sounds very nice and it's very nice to speak that way, but it's not. Again, it's just interesting. He says the Yemenite is the best, and he thinks Ashkenaz is better than Sfarad. He thinks the Sfarad is actually what's being done in the colloquial. He thinks is actually the worst. The Kalma Gomish is Av Temani Mishubach Mikulam. Okay, so there he says it very clearly. Skip a little further down.
There's a thing called, you know, language interference. And I mean, the Sfaradim, or Elu She'edot HaMizrach, which is better, they come from an Arabic-speaking country, which is a Semite country, language. And it's similar, not similar, but it's from the same group. They have a common denominator. They come from the same group of languages. Whereas Ashkenazim, so to speak, they come, of course, from Ashkenaz, as men, with the Yiddish. They have the Yiddish intonation, and then they speak, those who speak Polish, and those who speak Russian, and those who speak Hungarian. So all these languages definitely have affected the Hebrew.
Correct. I'm going to cut you off. We'll find Poskim who obviously... We'll find Poskim who bring this into bring this up as well. Yeah, so again, so is the isolation of the Yemenites is therefore make them better than the others, make them worse than the others. So it's going to be a little difficult to figure this out based upon anthropology. Yeah.
If he was here now,
yes.
I mean, in 1930 there were more Olim.
Yeah.
But now, let's say that you've been here for many years in Israel, are you supposed to go back to your roots of that your great-grandparents were from Poland and they spoke of the stuff? Or is your Mihad what's in modern Israel?
To speak or to doubt?
Well, to speak, I'm sure you didn't.
Okay. On page 17 of your sources, the last two lines.
17.
I have it. On page 17 of your sources, the last two lines, I have a tshuva from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach who raises that question. But he does say at the end, "Ach yodea ani ki e efshar klal afilu daber al zeh." He goes, I know I can't even speak about this. But he does, by saying that, he does speak about it. But as I said, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. He does bring up in the middle over here Rav Kook, who was somewhat of a mystic, does bring up in the middle, and don't forget all the mystical intonations of each and every letter, or each and every nikud, and the difference between a patach and a kamatz, or a segel, or a tseri, and so on and so forth. There's all kinds of mystical things in every single letter, so that also brings up. The main argument of Cook I cut out, you don't have it here. The main argument that he says is a very simple argument, and that is, Al titosh mitarati mecha. Do not abandon al titosh torati mecha. Do not abandon the Torah of your mother, which he says is that we have an obligation of following our customs. And if your custom has been something certainly for numerous generations, 10, 15 generations can be numerous generations, 20 generations, he says that we have no right to abandon that. And that, he thinks, is really the main argument. But again, Rav Kook gives this dual approach. One approach.
Because we have so many kids now who have two.
There's Musar Avicha and Torati Mecha.
Right.
It's basically the language and the customs that you received with your mother's milk. Meaning it's something which is...
Some Efrashim say Musar Avicha, it's the Masoret, and Torati Mecha is actually, you know, Ayima Shemachanechet.
So what Rav Kook is using by the argument of Torati Mecha is he's using an argument that we don't have a simple right just to abandon our customs. I mean, if I had far more, I wouldn't say the word guts. That's would be a silly word. If I were in the mood, then I would have discussed kitniyot. I would have discussed that, but it bores me. Somebody sent me a tshuva, quote unquote. Of course it will be. Somebody sent me a tshuva yesterday on how we have to tell everybody that they don't have to keep this part of kitniyot, that part of kitniyot. They can eat this, they can eat that, and any lateral kinds of things. And I wrote back to him. I said, And then he said, and I give you permission to publicize it, set it up, and to post it. I said, I won't post it because I don't agree with what you wrote. I said, even though I'm not naive, and I do believe that we're going to get to a situation in 2, 3, 4, 5 generations where there will be a sufficient amount of quote-unquote intermarriage between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, whereby the prohibition of kitniot will fall by the wayside. That is my personal... One second. That is my personal prediction as far as what will happen sooner rather than later. But that doesn't mean that that when I'm going to paskin a question that I tell people across the board, because one day this will fall into disuse, I hereby tell you all that you can disuse this. I mean, I just don't think that that's a proper approach. Which it doesn't beg the question, because ask me what the halacha is, I'll tell you what the halacha is. Then ask me, what's the halacha in an abnormal situation? Well, halacha... Let me tell you something interesting. I have a book someplace at home. If you want, I can bring it in. It was response to literature, written by a fellow named Isaac Klein. Any of you who know who Isaac Klein is? Okay. So Isaac Klein was... He was a conservative, quote-unquote, postic.
Okay. He did cheese. He spoke a lot about cheese.
He spoke about cheese. I can show you his tshuva. I can show you all his tshuva. They're fascinating. One after the other, tshuva are fascinating. But there's one thing that he has in common with all of his tshuva. He always ends up with a lenient decision. And by cheese, by the way, he says it. He goes, there are good and learned rabbis who say it's not allowed. And good and learned rabbis say it's good allowed. How dare we ignore the good and learned rabbis who say that it is allowed? What right do we have to ignore them? Regarding if you need a hechsher for cheese or not. If the rennet, if it's kosher, not kosher. So you know what? This was an argument that's taken place for a very long time in terms of rennet. Rabbi Soloveitchik could actually tell people, depending where they lived in Europe, that they should follow, again, alti tos torati mecha, you could follow your custom depending on where you lived. And although the flip side of it is that we live in a generation that people will all say the opposite, is that if there's somebody who says it's not allowed, how dare you you allow it? Right? Those of you who paid attention to the shiur, I don't know if you did, if you remember, that I gave a couple of years ago about women's hair covering. Do you remember what I said, or everything I said there you forgot?
Yeah, I'd like to hear. Yes.
I have to come back and give that chair again.
Or say the conclusion again.
Yeah, so that's one thing you remember is that I get one thing I said that shaytils are b'di'evid. That was one thing I said. How can I say shaytils are b'di'evid? Because according to most poskim, if you analyze it, shaytils are b'di'evid. It's not l'chadchila. The other thing that I said is that you're not allowed to go with one's hair uncovered, but how you cover it depends upon society.
I remember the braids.
And the braids, and I said braids were, okay. So ever since I gave the shiur, because it's online in various places, I get phone calls every now and again, but Rav Moshe Feinstein said so on. Now, again, let's admit something. I have no right, compared to Rav Moshe, again, be honest. Rav Moshe's children who tried to fight against, for lack of a better term, the art squirrelization of Rav Moshe, which means they wrote in the introduction to the last volume of Sheilot and Tshuvot, they wrote an accurate biography, taking away some of the quote-unquote miraculous stories that as they were saying Tehillim, in the Beit Midrash, in the middle the light goes out, and then they realized that he passed away. I mean, there is some things like that that made it into the art scroll rendition of the story. And they wrote an introduction saying, this was the real Rav Moshe, as opposed to the... Hagiography. And he, but they do admit that Rav Moshe learned Shulchan Aruch 190 times. He went through the entire Shulchan Aruch 190 times. So I will hereby admit that he's beat me by around 189 and a half times. Okay? So.
Having said that,
so what right do I possibly have to disagree with him? But on an individual topic, researching the individual issues, I came to the conclusion that Rav Moshe's psak in this particular point, and it's not the only place, the Rav Moshe's psak over here was one that I don't necessarily agree with. So, Rav Moshe combined two different sugyot. There's one sugya in Brachot, another sugya in Ketuvot. One talked about things which will cause men not to pray properly, or hi hurei avera. And the other sugya talks about when a man could divorce his wife because she's not acting properly. Rav Moshe brought the two together. He's not the only one, he's not the first one, he's not the last one. Moroccan poskim brought the two together to be mekel. Ashkenazim brought the two together to be machmir. When I learned through the two of them, and this is part of what I showed in the classes at the time, was that among the Rishonim, none of them brought the two together. There were no Rishonim who saw the two of these as being overlapping issues. They saw them as being two independent issues. So therefore, regarding the issue of how one should pray, it does say that even a tefach of something that should be covered, which is uncovered, is inappropriate to pray. So Rav Moshe, from that tefach, says, therefore, a woman has to cover hair and can't have a tefach left out. But that has nothing to do with the other Gemara, has nothing to do with the other sugya. How a woman can walk around outside has nothing to do with what it talks about in terms of a man's concentration for davening. So when it came to the conclusion, I have and I will tell people that for a woman to walk with her hair completely uncovered seems to be going against the Gemara and Ketuvot, but how she covers it goes to the sensibilities and sensitivities of that particular society. So that was very simply my conclusion. But as I said, how can I argue with Rav Moshe? Well, Rav Moshe, by the way, in his introduction says, go ahead and learn the sugud. If you disagree with me, then you know, let me know. But you have the right to disagree with me. Rav Moshe himself says this. He doesn't say that this is the word of God. So yeah.
No, I'm just going to go back to our topic with
Thank you.
Or are you going to keep me out? I just feel like, and I could be wrong here, but with Minhagim, didn't they develop because that's Jews live in different places in the world? Now that we have merged, like that we have, where we all live together. In the same communities.
No, we don't. The Jews still
live. There still are Jews. So fine. So the ones who live in Spain should keep citizenship. But the ones who live here, where we all live together, can it be accepted that we all.
And that's what I'm saying. Your point is correct. Your point is correct, and that's what I'm saying, that eventually.
There are batei knesiot that go back and forth. Like my sister Shul goes back and forth in the same tefillah. They'll do something in.
Right. So I'll say it again. I'll say it again. 2, 3, 4, 5 generations. Certain things will happen. It won't happen in every community, but it will happen in certain communities. And anybody who thinks that a new Eretz Yisrael minhag will not emerge eventually, then is a little. Is a little naive sociologically. I'm not saying that there won't be people who will keep to an old, but there will be a new thing that will emerge that will be something in the middle. And it's already emerged in lots of places. By the way, there is one postek who's already said this, and that is Rav Nachman Rabinovich, who when asked about issues of new communities that open up, and should they daven Ashkenaz and Sfarad, and let's say that you have 30 families and 18 or 1 or Ashkenaz and 12 or Sfarad or the other way around, and there's really not enough for two minyanim. So he said, he does say that a new minhag will eventually emerge. So, but as far as Kitnya goes, that's also going to eventually happen. But that doesn't mean that when I'm asked a question, I have to go against. Why would I bring up Isaac Klein? Because I said, is that every single answer, he found the lenient opinion, and he says that we basically, there seems to be an 11th commandment, thou shalt follow the lenient opinion. Okay? Again, so, and if I were to show you some of the discussions that he has and some of the conclusions that you have, you'd be absolutely shocked. How can he possibly say this? But I understand what he's doing. What he's doing is that he's dealing with a community who's basically a non-observant community and says, let me get to the lowest common denominator that people can keep at least something. I'm not going to argue with this, but I'm saying is that when one makes statements publicly, meaning what is public policy, there's a great deal of responsibility involved. When one gets up in an individual case, that's something else, which means, let's just say, for example, that your son-in-law, daughter-in-law's parents, and they happen to be Sephardic, invite you over for a meal on Pesach, do you now say to them, or they invite you all for the Seder, you, your children, your grandchildren, they invite you for the Seder. Do you say, well, I'm sorry, I can't eat by you because I know that you use kitniot on your dishes? Right? One second. Do you say that? And kitniot, as far as you're concerned, is as strict as chametz, which is simply not the case, or do you tell this person, go ahead, eat, enjoy the holiday with your family, you shouldn't eat kitniot. And if they serve kitniot and put it on your plate, push it aside and eat the rest of the food on your plate. which means that's something I would say to that particular person in that particular situation. But I'm not going to go up and say, as public policy goes, all Ashkenazim can eat in any restaurant they want. It doesn't make a difference if they serve rice, whatever, because I don't think that's proper, which means it comes that there's a difference between saying something for public policy versus dealing with sensitivity to individual questions. What I'm aware of is that there will be enough of these individual issues that will come up that will eventually win over. But I'm saying it's not going to happen today, not tomorrow. And look, there was somebody who publicized something last year also with kitniot, and it says that kitniot is minhag galuti. It's not authentic Torah Judaism and should be forgotten with the galut, and we need to follow Torah Eretz Yisrael. So, I also think that that was...
They didn't have rights in Eretz Yisrael then, so...
Actually, according to one of the opinions, Rav Yochanan ben Nuri, if I'm not mistaken, he actually said that you should have rice on your Seder plate. It was one of the things on the Seder plate. Yeah. Rice on the Seder plate. The Nusach Achid was created by Rav Gorin and never really caught on. Okay, let's go to... So let's conclude with Rav Kook. Rav Kook said three major arguments. One argument was you have no right to abandon your customs. That's what you heard a little bit of saying in terms of the Yemenites and so on. Nobody should be abandoning their customs. Al titosh Torah timecha. You have no right to abandon your customs. Everybody should be keeping. He envisioned the new Israel of having a bunch of communities together, which again is very, very interesting because part of the kibbutz galiot, would it really work long term as having a bunch of independent communities? Or would the eventual kibbutz galiot be a melting pot? Which means that's really the question that comes up. He therefore said, as chief rabbi, he says that each community should keep their own customs, nobody should abandon their customs. He points out that even if you think that Rabbi Yossi, the law is like Rabbi Yosef, lo diktek yotze, he says, that's b'dievet. But if you learn like the Sefer Chinuch, then you're not even yotze. So as I said, that was the clever thing that he did. He pulled the Sefer Chinuch out of his hat. By the way, the Sefer Chinuch is not all that impressive for me for a different reason. Again, I apologize for saying impressive, because I just want to remind you of that other point. And what was that? If you read it in English, you were yotze. So again, it's not all... that simple. By the way, this is not the only psak of Rav Kook that religious Zionists have completely ignored. The other one was that he was against women voting. He was against women having a vote. Pre-suffrage days, he said, "Women voting? What are you talking about?" Look, this is one of the things, and again, we could admit this as well. Merkaz Arav, which follows Rav Kook, in some ways completely has ignored Rav Kook. In certain ways, they follow Rav Kook. Rav Kook was, despite his broadness, was in certain areas very, very, quote-unquote, Haredi. In some ways, you'll find he's more Haredi than others were, which means we get deluded that because somebody will say, Hallelujah, Yom Ha'atzma'ut, that means that everything else about them is going to be very, very modern, as it were. That's just simply not the case. But as I said, even followers of Rav Kook have not been... The Mizrahi, for example, just absolutely ignored Rav Kook on this. You don't want to lose half of your votes, do you? So in pragmatic terms, maybe all the secularists or leftists who see Rav Kook as the enlightened rabbi, maybe they should follow his psak on this, especially merits and so on. Okay, let's continue. Rav Uziel, source number 8. Dikto kavarata tnoot umiftaha utiyot bekriyat shema tefila vekriyat haTorah. Sounds familiar, right? Aliyat kenusei hagola la'eret Yisrael shehit orara b'chesed Hashem aleinu b'tkufateinu zot v'tchiyat ha'safa evrit b'tur safat ha'dibur shel am Yisrael ha'yoshev ba'aretz shehu muflag l'sfot ha'goliutiyot ruvot mishunot umiftaim shonim gam b'sfat haTorah, and so on and so on. What's he describing? Kibbutz Goliot is taking place. The Jews are coming from all over the place. The language is coming alive, right? Something new is being created. What should we do? So he says, Sheila Zu, where it's underlined, Kishamda bimosdot hachinuchu vashuk, right? Be it educational institutions, not necessarily religious, by the way, be it educational institutions or be it in the streets, in the marketplace, kibla et pitrona b'li shum kshayim. They came up to a solution. A solution emerged. בהתקבל המפתח הספרדי בשינויים קלים, בתוך שפת הדיבור והלימוד. They accepted the Sephardic pronunciations. אבל כשעמדה שאלה זו בדבר של חובה ומצוות, כגון קריאת התורה וקריאת שמע ותפילה, but when, meaning that was good for educational institutions and for the streets. But in the marketplaces. But what happens when we're talking about things of religious value? V'chein kol dvim shetrichim min hadin la'umram b'lashon ha'kodesh, regarding all things that need to be said in Hebrew. Einanu rasha'im lahaskim mida'atenu l'kol ma shenir'e yafeh u'mitzatzel b'ni'umuto. We have no right simply to follow the word on the street, and just because something has a nice ring to it. Aval anu chayvim l'mtzol pitrona shalacha zu mitoch mekor v'halacha. We need to find a solution and guidance based upon halacha. משיחתי עם אחדים מגדול הרבנים שבדורנו, in my discussions with some great rabbis of this generation, שמעתי מפיהם שפסקו הלכה זו בסכינה חריפה ואמרו. They've paskened this with a very sharp knife, as it were. And it says, אין אדם יוצא ידי חובתו בקריאת כל דבר שבחובה ומצווה, אלא דווקא כשנמרה במיתורי אשכנזי. So that is, he's referring to Rav Kook. You know, certain rabbis, he does not say him by name, have said that an Ashkenazi can only be Yotzei, and that's following this Al-Titar Shtartimech on the one hand, and the Sefer Chinuch on the other, and they said, V'yichriyu mida'atam b'rayot v'hasha'arot she'in lehem alma she'yismachu. And they've based themselves on things that really have nothing to rely on. Now you realize he's not agreeing. She'mifta Ashkenazi hu ha'mikori v'hayisodi. Upaslu kol mivta'im acherim, that they've decided that Ashkenazi, and there are those who will see, went this far and says, this is the authentic way of speaking, others are not. V'hein atari iti divri maran hagon hagadol morenu v'harbenu harav avim yitzchak kohen kuk. He goes, I've seen his article. Shemasik lalacha de'ein l'shanam mivta'al mivta'al, that person shouldn't change. Ach mishum dekol shinu nechshav v'gabe elu v'chlal korei v'lo diktuk ba'otiyoteh sh'asor l'chadchilu v'dat achinuch ene yotzi yidei chava. Look at that. Wasn't that really easy? We just could have read these two lines and gotten the whole thing. Afilu b'diyev, but if no safal zeh, kol achat me'ediyot chayavot l'kayem min haga mishum al titosh torat imecha, ki kabalat avot hu kiyuma shel torah v'shal avicha v'yegedcha kativ ad kan dvarav.
Titosh torat imecha is not halacha. It's a suggestion, it's a sefer chinuch. It's not halacha?
יכול להיות שבכל זאת זה הלכה. כשאני לעצמי רגיל הייתי לומר בלכה זו, and what I would generally say when people would ask, כל ואין בידינו להכריע, we have no ability to really decide, והוא ולא עמדה עד כה לדיון של כנסיות רבנים שבדל לדון להכריע, מוטב לנהוג בה דעבד כמר עבד ודעבד כמר עבר. He says, the whole time we haven't had a group of rabbis getting together and discussing this in a serious way, what he's saying is, I'm not giving in just because some other rabbi gave a psak that doesn't agree with me. He goes, either we're going to have a quote-unquote Sanhedrin or a convocation of rabbis to really decide the halakha on a general level. Otherwise, there's a machloket here, and you want to follow that opinion, follow that opinion, you want to follow that other opinion. And he's saying is that there's no, as far as he's concerned, there's no basically, there's no hachra. And then he writes where it's underlined next, ולכן הייתי אומר, הנח לבני ישראל, אם אינם נביאים, בני נביאים הם, וימצאו מפתח הרצוי והישר. And he says, I have faith in the Jewish people that they will figure out to do this in the proper way. If they're not prophets, they're sons of prophets, which is a line which you're familiar with, which is quoted in the Gemara. And if this is what Am Yisrael chooses to do, then obviously this is something which God wants them to do. מאמור יוצא דין ברור ששינוי מפתאים אינם גורמים שלא להוציא את הקורא ידי חובתו, אפילו מניח שהוא תואר בהברתו, הוא ולכל הלך אחרי כוונת הלב. And he says, if a person mispronounces, this is of no significance, because what's the important thing by davening? Kavana. Kavana. Important thing is kavana. וביור עניין, וכל הקורא מדקת לקרוא כהוגן, באותו עברה שהוא רגיל, ושבחר בו יוצא ידי חובתו. And therefore, anybody who prays in any havara is יוצא. You want to say in Ashkenazis, fine. You want to say in Sfaradit, fine. Any and all Havarot, according to Rav Uziel, are acceptable. Let's skip a little bit. We'll go towards the second to the last paragraph of the page. וכן כתב הכנסת הגדולה בשם הרדב"ז, שאם כל בני עירו מדברים כך, מותר לנותו שץ, מותר לישא את כפיו אם הוא כהן, דון מיני בני דון דידן, ששפה מדוברת בבתי הספר ובשפות, אם היא בעברה ספרדית, ודבר זה הולך ומתפשט, לא רק בארץ, אלא גם בגולה, וכיוון שכן מותר למנות שליח ציבור מדבר וקורא בעברה זו. Basically, what he's saying is that if you live in a town that most people pray in this way, you can pray in this way. He's saying if the spoken havara is Sfaradit on the street, then you can certainly daven that way. You know, meaning he's saying there's no logic to say that this is what's spoken, but you can't pray that way. He says it doesn't make any sense to distinguish between the spoken word and the holy word, as it were. And then he writes the bottom paragraph, Atana hadar anpin, and now we're going to turn our faces, levarer ladun, im yesh bishinoi miftaim mishum al titosh tarat imecha, o sha'al avicha v'yagedcha, shezehu yisod kol ha-tarat ha-minhagim. And it's not just the Rav Kook uses here. Now listen, I don't want to get too far into the whole issue of minhagim, especially at this particular time, but there are some people who will point out to you that minhag is the same letters as gehinom, and therefore a bad minhag takes you to hell. And there are others who've claimed that if you don't follow your minhagim, then you go to hell. Which is basically, take. I will read for you what you don't have on page 5, and that is the conclusion of Rav Aziel. והנח להם לישראל אם אין הנביאים בני נביאים, כל זה אמרתי כדי להוכיח לפי אני ידעתי שאין ביכולתנו כעת להורות הוראה מסוימת בבחירת מבטא זו או אחר, ואין ביכולתנו גם לומר שקורא מבטא אחר בזה, מזה שקיפל מאבותיו ורבותיו לא יצא ידי חבותו ונכשל בעל תיטוש תורת אימך. אולם אין זה פותר אותנו מלדון בהלכה זו לעומקה לקבוע בכניסייה של חכמים. He goes back to what he said in the beginning. Again, he basically brings a number of proofs that he thinks that there's nothing to do with being abandoning your parents. He doesn't think that there's any kind of prohibition over here. He does think at the end of the day that there will be a necessity for rabbis to get together, which of course never happened, and to decide together what to do. And he said, and he goes, and think about it, that must have been what was done when Ezra came back and so on. They must have come to some kind of decision on how to do things in those days. And basically, you understand Rav Uziel's psak. So, what are we left at this point? At this point, we have a major machloket between Rav Uziel and Rav Kook. You can imagine, look, and I'll say the same thing. Rav Kook could have said as strong as he wanted, he lost, he didn't even win his own yeshiva. Right, his own followers have abandoned him on this, and for the most part, the only people who follow Rav Kook on this, and I'm sure they'll be amused, is the Eide Charedis and so on, which. And I'm kidding a little bit, but I'm saying essentially, for people who've been in Israel for multiple generations, there's the sort of people who don't follow Rav Kook are the ones who follow Rav Kook. That's the irony over here. Coming attractions, we still have a tshuva from Rav Herzog, a tshuva from the Sri De'esh, a couple of tshuvas from Moshe Feinstein, from the Minchat Yitzchak, Rabbi Weiss, another tshuva from, where he says the exact opposite, from Rav Herzog, and then, of course, we'll let Rav Ovadia, at the end, argue with everybody, and then Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Which, I mean, but basically, those are the biggest poskim of the last 75 years. And they all weigh in on this, and there's a lot of more interesting things to say. I mean, basically, the machloket you've heard, but the nuances now are going to be, so what do we do in terms of a tzibur? What do we do in terms of schools? What do we do in schools in Chutz La'aretz? Is that the same thing as over here? Should we change the minhag of a whole country, right? Should we... what happens in terms of a kid who's bar mitzvah? Should he get up and should we let him read from the Torah if he reads differently from the community? And then we, get, as I said, get all kinds of questions, micro and macro questions coming up. And yesh harbei lagid al zadayim. We will continue. Yes. Oh. Was that the only reason you came to hear that? Do you remember? do you remember a couple months ago? Some of you remember. Remember a couple months ago? I came to class. I asked about fixing up my friend. So, one person from the class contacted me. They thought they had something. No. Somebody else tried. They work with somebody and somebody's cousin. It didn't work. A week after the class, I got an email from Louisiana. I don't know very many people in Louisiana. And she said that she had heard from somebody. There was apparently one woman in the class that day who was only there that day. I don't know her. Some woman from New York who was there during her intercession. She was visiting. And she said, I spoke to this woman in New York and said that you may have something for a guy. And then she continues and says, there's a rabbi in Geula who I spoke to, who apparently the woman in Louisiana called the rabbi in Geula for something for her son. And the rabbi in the Geula said, well, this other woman called me about a shidduch. Maybe you know a shidduch for this other woman. So then the woman from Louisiana called the woman in New York who gave her my email. And then she contacted me and asked if she can give the rabbi in Geula my phone number, which he did. And I spoke to him and he suggested I speak to this woman who lives in Ranana. Now, of course, what was interesting, there was one deal breaker with the guy who had sent me. He said, you know, I'm very open, I'm very broad-minded, and as long as she has no contact with any Hasidim. I mean, the Hasidim is not going to work. So anyway, so they got engaged last week. They had L'chaim on Wednesday night. And the Hasidic Rebbe is going to be Masada Kedusha. So the moral of the story over here is, call a kavod for you, and we have to take upon ourselves more mitzvot.